Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. And the show is also podcasting on the internet at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen at any time of day, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. All this week, we are rebroadcasting the opera series that ran here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe earlier this year. This week, the Santa Fe Opera is presenting all five of the season's operas, so each day this week, we're playing the corresponding program. For more information and tickets, call the Santa Fe Opera box office at 986-5900 or find them online at santafeopera.org. And I'd like to welcome Desiree Mays. She is the author of Opera Unveiled, the annual book that accompanies the Santa Fe Opera. Welcome, Desiree.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
It's wonderful to have you back. And we're here to talk today about Daphne, the opera by Richard Strauss, which is a 20th century opera. It premiered in 1935 in Dresden. Tell us about Strauss and tell us about the opera.
Well, it's a lot of ground to cover, but we'll try. Richard Strauss had an amazing career. He started out as a conductor and as a composer of tone poems. Already there was a departure from the type of music that was being presented in his youth. And after a wonderful career of tone poems, he turned to opera, and he shocked the entire opera world with Salome and Electra. Those were his opening shots in the world of opera, which were pretty hair-raising at the time, and depending on how they're presented today, can still be pretty hair-raising. The Santa Fe Opera did Salome recently, and we've done Electra, of course. And then he sort of took a step backwards and composed with the great librettist Hugo von Hofmann style. These were a wonderful double act. This is an example in this opera of this pairing of Strauss and Hofmann style, how well they work together. And they step backwards to do Der Rosenkavalier, which is a neoclassical piece. They move back more to the time of Mozart, a complete contrast to Salome and Electra. And those were the first three operas that were really put Richard Strauss on the operatic map, as it were. And actually, those have been the three operas most presented in this country for many years. He was only known for those three, and people were wondering, well, what did he do afterwards? He did a number of wonderful operas afterwards, and the Santa Fe Opera, I must say, has to be congratulated for being the opera company in this country that has presented Richard Strauss's other operas after those three. In fact, the Santa Fe Opera was the first company to present Daphne in 1964, which was, 30 years odd after the premiere. So after Der Rosenkavalier, Strauss often turned to Greek or Roman myth for the source of his operas. He did the Egyptian Helen, which is a parodied piece of Helen of Troy, Ariadne of Naxos, which is a wonderful piece as well, the Love of Danae, the Liber de Danae, in which the god, great god Jupiter, Zeus, appears as a shower of gold. He actually does that again this season in another opera. We'll get to that in Plate. And he wrote this very beautiful piece, Daphne. Daphne is a one-act opera. He called it a bucolic tragedy in one act. That means it is a pastoral setting, nymphs and shepherds, and it's a sort of a very imaginative piece, but it's approached seriously. He tells the famous myth of Daphne. Daphne, who is the daughter of the river god, and Gaia, the earth mother, who is in love with nature. She's sort of emotionally unawakened as a teenager, as one of the reviewers put it. She's only in love with nature and the day, the trees and the flowers. And the young man who loves her, Leucippus, plays his flute for her. She has no time for him. And when the opera opens, it's the Feast of Dionysus. So all the shepherds and the herdsmen are coming, gathering. Panoeus, the father, is at the head of this group, and they're going to have these annual fertility rites, which is amongst the animals as well as the people, one of those wild orgies that we hear about and see on the mosaics. And Daphne wants no part of this. She loves the day, and she doesn't want anything to do with the night. And Leucippus suggests to her that they grew up as children, but now on the Feast of Dionysus, he is a man, and he wants to love her as a man. And she will have nothing to do with him. So this is where the opera opens. And maybe we should play part of that duet right off at this point. The duet where Leucippus comes to Daphne and he jumps out behind a tree and he tells her that he has loved playing his flute for her, but now it's the time for him to declare his love for her. And in so doing, he breaks his flute at the end of this piece. But this is part of their very beautiful duet near the beginning of the opera Daphne by Richard Strauss.
Thank you.
And so Leucippos ends that wonderful duet singing I Love You, Ich liebe dich, Daphne. The recording we're listening to today is from the Vienna Symphony. It's a DGG recording. Carl Böhm is the conductor. He was actually the conductor of the premiere, and the whole opera was dedicated to him. He and Richard Strauss were good friends. This is one of the great recordings of this opera, actually, from 1964. The Daphne is Hilda Gurdon, Apollo, James King, the Penoyes, Paul Schuffler, and Leucippos, whom we just heard, Fritz Wunderlich.
Now, I speak German. I couldn't understand a word they were saying.
And that's actually okay, Marisha. If people go to opera to understand the words, they're probably better going to a play without the music. And I have a very clear sort of understanding or feeling about this issue. Should we be translating our operas, German, French, Spanish, French, Italian, Russian, into English? I think really not. I think the opera should always be presented in the language in which it was written. Because after all, the composer composed his music for the sound of the words as they are sung in his language.
And you can't understand them in English anyway.
No, that's right. So if you have amore in Italian, it's not going to sound like love is not going to do it in English. And now it is going to be difficult to understand, even if it's in English, sometimes especially if it's in English. Singers, no matter how well they enunciate, much of it will be understood and can carry, you know, over the footlights into a 2,000-seat house. That's no mean undertaking. But at certain notes and pitches, they're not going to be able to really enunciate. So struggling to follow the dialogue as you're listening to the singer, whether you do it as you can in German, French, or English, you really should give that up. I think it's impossible.
Especially because at the opera they have those wonderful titles scrolling across the chairs in front of you anyway.
This was one of the great revelations, I suppose, of our time. The Metropolitan Opera had the first back-of-the-seat titles, and now we have an updated version of that really make it very simple. So as you sit in the theater, you have a little tiny screen in front of you and a button that goes on, off, and on will give you the German in English, or if it's in English, it'll also give you the English translation, the dialogue. So you can understand the words as they're happening. There are also challenges with this, however, so that you end up with a number of different libretti, little books, little texts for each opera, because the singers will have one, the one to which the music was composed. In order to condense that, if four singers are singing a quartet, there's no way four lines are going to fit, and you're going to be able to follow every single word on the title on the back of the chair. So they get foreshortened somewhat. So you should not be too critical. I know people who know the operas well in their original tongue who say, well, the titles bore very little resemblance to what's going on. Now, actually, you know, there
that
is
that happens in the movies, too.
Exactly. For any movie that's dubbed, I mean, you pick up
that's
very
subtitled.
Quickly. Yeah, they've changed the sense, and that can change a lot, actually. So the best way, I think, to deal with this is to know the story ahead of time. If you're fairly familiar with the story outline and what's going on, then the dialogue will come to you through the music. The music is what will tell you what's really going on. That is the point of reference. And I think if you're trying to follow the dialogue with your head intellectually, it's cutting you off from the experience of the music. It's a much it's a much purer, if you like, experience to just allow the music to tell the story. In Mozart, for instance, some of the dialogue is pretty inane. I mean, as I said before, some of these librettos leave a lot to be desired in terms of the writing. So the music needs to do it for you. And with Mozart, you only need to listen to the music, not the words at all. But they are there. And I must say, this has opened up opera to hundreds of thousands of people being able to understand. You can follow the line. And if you get, say, an early piece of opera where one line may be sung 10 times over, that's okay. You read it once. But then the succeeding times, you begin to really get into it and the sense of it as it's repeated in the musicological form and the time of that period. So I think this has been a great plus to opera. And people who know opera, I've been very interested, just turn the titles off. If you follow the titles the first time, the second time you go back, you probably won't use those much because, again, you're getting that experience in a much more heartfelt way.
And, of course, for people who want to know the stories, they can pick up Desiree May's book, Opera Unveiled, which is available at the opera and at many local bookstores. The whole book is 76 pages long, and so it's very easy to read. It's just a few pages, really, on each opera. So it's very easy to get the story and get the background of each one. It's a wonderful contribution.
It's the background and the context, I think, is important. And each time a new season is announced, and we're going to hear soon about next year's season, you know, I wait wondering what I'm going to be presented with, because for me as a speaker, it's really thrilling, right, to know, you know, what am I going to have to deal with. This happens every time I'm invited to lecture as well. And first of all, do I have the date free? And then secondly, what is the opera? When I was told I'd have to do a chapter on Madame Mao, I had really, you know, misgivings. I thought, this is one woman I really do not need to know about. And I did the research, such as it is. She wrote one of the autobiographies of her life, which is mainly fantasy, and then there's no true story of Madame Mao. And she was evil incarnate. I mean, there's absolutely no question. But how incredible to be exposed to that. Each opera brings me to a whole new world of learning, whether it's in history or philosophy or people or interaction or love stories or what we do to one another. And in many cases, you can empathize with the character because you've been there. You've been in that love situation. Or other times you may not be familiar with it, but we'll get an appreciation of other people who may be in a difficult situation by understanding the challenges through an opera. It takes emotions and heightens them. The stories of operas are typically not too complex. It has to be a fairly direct storyline. You can't do a lot of flashbacks. You can't do a lot of landscape description, clearly, because you're going to see it. But you can get a very direct story, and the characters are larger than life. I mean, literally, as you pointed out, some singers are very big. Daphne's an example. In order to be able to sing Daphne or Electra or Salome, all of whom are young teenage girls, Richard Strauss himself said he hoped that Salome could have the voice of an Elizabeth Schwarzkopf, which is a very fine, beautiful voice, but has to be housed in a big body to be able to sing these scores. I mean, he really challenged his singers. And Strauss is known for a great big orchestra. His orchestral music is so beautiful. I mean, you're lost in a wash of sound. There's no question. Can I read a little bit about From Opera Unveiled? Just maybe a quick way of talking about the opera, because we could go on about this. The music in Daphne is melodic and flowing, a lyrical poem which tells the tale with much passion and psychological insight. Delicate and transparent at times, the score is solemn and dramatic at others. It is most compelling in its depiction of the rustic atmosphere of the world of nature, for this truly is a nature tale. Daphne, part child, part nymph, is in love with the beauty of nature that she finds all round her in the trees, the flowers, and the sunlight. She sings in her opening aria, O bleib geliebter Tag, O stay, beloved day, to her brothers, the trees, and sisters, the flowers. In love with the day and the sun's light, she fears the cold, dark night, and is unsettled by the imminent feast of Dionysius. The clumsy people trampling the grass, their savage singing offends my ear. She longs for the shelter the trees provide after Apollo, the mighty god of the sun, completes his ride across the heavens and enters Mount Olympus at the end of the day. The enraptured Daphne embraces the tree to music that is sweet and mysterious in a mood of delicate impressionism.
So, now, the music was, it was, how should we say it, looking back to another
to romanticism,
it
yes.
It was a romanticism.
Yes. Strauss was really not in writing about verismo or realism or contemporary or modern opera. This was really not what he was about, certainly in this opera and all of the Greek operas. He looks a little back to romanticism and to the tone poem. Much of the music in this opera can stand alone as it describes the feelings and the passions of the characters. Beautiful instrumentation, very big, sweeping sound. At the ending, we'll keep the ending for a little bit. But we did mention Apollo, so maybe it's time to get that. In the Roman myth, Apollo is the god of the sun who drives his chariot across the heavens each day. And looking down one day, he's stopped by the radiance of Daphne, this nymph. So he comes down to the earth, disguised as a cowherd, to pursue her. And she, on the other hand, is not interested in this god. She doesn't know who he is, but she senses there's something very mysterious about him, and she rejects him. Now, in the original myth, he chases her through the woods, and she cries out to the river god to save her, and she is transformed into the laurel tree that she loves. And Apollo, the god, then realizes that he has to, you know, behave like a god, and he asks Zeus that in her wish being granted, that he too wishes for her that every time a hero is honored, that his head would be wreathed with a laurel wreath. That's the origin of the story. I mean, that's what the story was all about. It was to show how Daphne became the laurel wreath of Apollo. He said, the laurel wreath will adorn my lyre and the sun chariot. And that's where the laurel wreath came from. That's the original meaning. Daphne means laurel.
It's funny when you say behave like a god. I mean, both the god and the mortal are spending most of the opera trying to get into her gossamer gown.
Absolutely.
And gods do that a lot.
Well, the gods were notorious. I mean, the Zeus was spent. I mean, there's Ovid, the author, the Roman author of the first century, who wrote a book called Metamorphoses. Most people will know this. It chronicles what the goings on of the gods. I mean, it was quite incredible.
In a
satirical manner. Jupiter was notorious. I mean, there's Leda and the Swan. The swan was Jupiter. Europa and the bull was Jupiter. You could go on and on. There are many examples. And Apollo, they all transformed at will. I mean, they transformed themselves or their victims. When Juno, the wife of Jupiter, found out that Jupiter was having an affair with Io, Jupiter turned Io, the maiden nymph, into a heifer to protect her. But Juno found out about it, and she sent a gadfly to sting Io for the rest of her life. So she's running around the world. It's terrible things, metamorphoses. And this was the origin of the book. Maybe we should talk a little bit about that. Ovid was writing really a satirical tale. The great god Apollo comes down in a way that is not honest. He comes down to earth and says he's a cowherd. Actually, we can play this example. It's track 8 we're going to play of Apollo's entrance. He comes on the feast of Dionysus pretending to honor Panoeus and Dionysus, but really he's coming for Daphne. And he says that his herd had smelt the roasting meat and smelled the wine, and they stampeded. And in this short selection that I'll play for you, you'll hear the stamping of the beasts as they come to Panoeus for the Feast of Dionysus.
Talking to Desiree Mays, whose book Opera Unveiled unveils this opera, Daphne by Richard Strauss, and the four other operas that are being presented by the Santa Fe Opera this summer. So Daphne, so where are we in our story?
Okay, so Apollo has arrived at the Feast of Dionysus, and now Daphne is in the middle of all this situation where Leucippus, her childhood friend, wants to make love to her, and Apollo has shown up, and she's not quite sure about him. So what happens is where Apollo is greeted by her father, and then Daphne is asked to serve him, and she brings a cup of wine and a beautiful cape. She takes his arms, his bow and arrow from him, gives him the drink and the cape around his shoulders, and Apollo is overwhelmed by her beauty. She reminds him of his twin sister Artemis, or Diana, depending whether you're into Greek or Roman myth, and he calls her sister, which is exactly the way to approach her, as it turns out, because she has this brother-sister relationship. She's not yet up for a real relationship. So he repeats to her the words that she sung in her first aria, how she misses the sun leaving the day to the night. And she's amazed. How could he know of this? And then finally he enfolds her in his arms and he kisses her. And at this point she realizes this is no
That's
brother.
That's not very brotherly.
Not very brotherly. So she runs from his embrace. And then Leucippus comes, and they demand of Apollo, who is he? Who are you? You are not the cowherd you pretend to be. So in this next section I'd like to play for you, the opening aria here is so thrilling. It's for a young, heroic, Germanic tenor voice at its very best. It's sung beautifully on this recording. He says, I am the sun god. I am the sun. And Daphne responds, thinking, yes, I knew there was something, there was something about him. But Leucippus turns and says, you're a liar. He calls the god a liar, and Apollo does a very human thing. He loses his temper, and he fires the bow and the arrow strikes Leucippus, and Leucippus falls. And you'll hear this in the music. You'll hear the sound of the arrow flying through the air. And as he falls, Daphne runs to his side, realizing that perhaps she does love Leucippus, but of course it's all too late, and the god stands back and realizes the damage that he has caused. So let's listen to this section. It's track 10 of Apollo and Daphne and Leucippus.
Oh,
And that was a section from Daphne by Richard Strauss from the Cowboom recording, with Hilda Gurdon as Daphne, Apollo sung by James King, and Lucapus by Fritz Wunderlich. Three great singers in one of the climaxes, I suppose, of this opera.
Well, and it represents Daphne's sexual awakening.
Yes, at the point at which she's lost the man she would have loved, silly girl.
she would have loved, or would she have, if Apollo hadn't killed him with his
exactly.
arrow?
Exactly. There's a real confusion here between gods and humans, the gods showing all too human-like failings, or strengths, depending on how you view it. But this is called a bucolic tragedy, which already seems to be a...
That sounds like an oxymoron.
Yes, exactly. It really does. And it is pastoral. It's about nymphs and shepherds, and it's a playful piece. I mean, Daphne is, she's not entirely human. I mean, her father was the river god and her mother the earth mother. That makes it entirely possible that she would have this affinity with the trees. And in Richard Strauss's treatment of the story, he tells it straight, as it were, as a tone poem, a very beautiful reflective piece of longing. There's always in Romanticism a sense of loss and longing. In fact, in this next section I'd like to play, it's Daphne's lament when Leucippos dies. She runs to his side, and just last week at a meeting for Opera America, I heard the composer Osvaldo Gonahoff talk about opera in terms of lament and prayer. The very first opera, Orfeo, was about that. So is this. And maybe all our stories are a lament for what we have lost or what we may lose, and prayer of hope for things that are good and wonderful that make us happy. And our lives are lived out somewhere between those two. That was a beautiful idea, and he played examples from the very first opera and then from his opera, Aina de Mar, which was here last year. And we're all caught up, I suppose, in lament of loss and prayer and hope for the future. So this is Daphne's lament on the death of Leucippos. It's very beautiful. Think of what has happened to her here. She's come to the realization that she's loved by the sun, Apollo himself, but she does not want his love. She realizes now her love really was for Leucippos, who has died. And that was Daphne Hilda Gooden from the recording of 1964. We're going to have a wonderful Daphne singing for us here in Santa Fe. Her name is Erin Wall. She's a young singer, actually a Canadian-American, who comes from the Chicago Lyric Opera Center program. I heard her sing in Das Rheingold at the Ring last year, and she's quite beautiful. It's a very demanding role, but there's two long, very difficult arias, and then the entire transformation at the end. The director of our production here is going to be Mark Lamos, who has actually directed Broadway shows, Seascape and The Rivals. It's interesting that a number of Broadway directors are making the transition into opera.
Actually,
not so much the other way, come to think, from opera to musical, though that is happening. But they have a real sense of staging and theater that I think will be very exciting. And the conductor is Kenneth Montgomery, who is actually conducting his 25th season at the Santa Fe Opera, which is quite something. He's much loved here with a deep understanding of Richard Strauss's music, so I think that'll be something to look forward to in Daphne this summer here.
Now, at the end, Daphne is transformed into a tree, and I've never seen this opera, and I keep wondering how they pull that off on stage.
Yes, that's always the big question, along with Salome and her veils. How are they going to transform a woman, a singer, into a tree? That, again, is one of the feats that are accomplished by a production team with lighting and effect. And musically, again, it happens musically. She sings. As Apollo leaves the stage, she stands from the dead body beside the body of Leucippus, and she feels the earth rising in her. Are her lines, and she sings about this, how she welcomes the trees and her branches and how ecstatic she is by this transformation. In the original story, at this point, Apollo caught her, but her heart was still beating under the bark of the tree, and he's literally hugging a tree at this point.
The
first tree hugger, absolutely. But the transformation is happening, and in the music, it's quite beautiful. She starts singing, and then the orchestra takes over, and the transformation, again, is within your soul. You hear it in the music, no matter what really is happening on stage. With lighting effects these days, the impossible can be achieved. A woman can transform into a tree. Our staging, I understand, will be a fairly bare staging, so the action will be amongst the performers, the singers, the actors, the dancers. There's a marvelous bacchanalian dance at the feast in the middle of this opera. But at the librettist, Joseph Gregor, really wanted at the end of this opera to have the mother and father and the chorus, the shepherds, come back and sing a hymn of praise to the gods. But Strauss put his foot down. He said, absolutely not. This opera will end with Daphne being transformed into a tree, and we will be left with nothing but the sound of her voice in the leaves. So at the very end, she doesn't even sing words. It's just sounds, and it's the sounds of the tree shimmering in the moonlight as the opera ends. And the music that Strauss composed for this is really quite extraordinarily beautiful. That last 10 minutes of the opera is quite hair-raisingly lovely.
And so that's what we're going to hear now.
Thank you.
So that's the wonderful ending of the opera Daphne, as she the nymph turns into a tree.
And she doesn't sound entirely unhappy about
it.
I mean, it ends in a major key. She sounds...
She's absolutely delighted. That's where she wants to be. She's completely happy. She can be loved by Apollo, the sun god, as he goes across the heavens every day. And this, for Daphne, is a happy ending. And it's an ending that's quite spectacular at the Santa Fe Opera, since we're an outdoor theater, to see that moonlight shining on the tree at the end. To that music on a moonlit night up there is one of the most extraordinary experiences of theater one could ever hope to have.
So, ladies and gentlemen, check your ephemeris and look for the full moon and buy your tickets for Daphne.
For Daphne on the appropriate night. That's a good idea.
So, we are speaking with Desiree Mays, who is the author of the book Opera Unveiled, which comes out every year to accompany the five operas of the Santa Fe opera season. You are also giving lectures.
Yes, I lecture at the opera every night, run of the show, which is really great. We have they have wonderful preview buffets, which are al fresco dinners on the opera grounds. It's a great way to go to the opera. You can go early, get your car parked, and be relaxed and ready, have a lovely meal with some wine, and I come up with dessert and tell you something about the opera, and then go to the opera. It makes it a wonderful evening, and to go to that, you need to talk to the box office, and they'll take care of it all. Please come and say hello to me when you get there.
And so Desiree May's book, Opera Unveiled, can be procured at the opera or at any local bookstore. Just ask your independent local bookstore for the book. And you can, of course, check the Santa Fe Opera at santafeopera.org on the internet. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org, and we are podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe on iTunes. You just go to your iTunes and check us out in the iTunes store. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Tim Pemberton for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz. Once again, for more information and tickets, call the Santa Fe Opera box office at 986-5900 or go online at santafeopera.org. Sie verbrochen.